from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. It doesn't matter how old you are. When you walk into your parents' home, you might as well be 15 again, or is it 13? The same old narratives lock into place, the same wounds reopen, the same fights rekindle. These days, the experts call this phenomenon holiday regression. You know, when you find yourself inhabiting old roles with kin, the family jokester, the appeaser, the instigator. The holidays, of course, trigger regression, but Form can help you avoid a rerun this week. It's an hour of free therapy, so join the conversation as our experts give you some tips to stay sane between now and the new year. Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Forget all the progress you thought you'd made towards becoming a well-functioning, respected member of society. When you step back into the family dynamic you grew up in, it's hard to remember what's on your business card or who loves you and how in the real world. Does this sound fair? Does this sound familiar to you? It's what the experts call holiday regression. But enough about me. We've got some experts here this hour to talk to you about you and your family dynamic. Here in studio, we have Kelsey Crowe, empathy researcher and visiting scholar at the Center on Civility and Democratic Engagement, which sounds like a good idea for most families, from UC Berkeley, co-author of There Is No Good Card for This. Thank you. And Aretha Hampton, licensed clinical social worker, sole proprietor of Roots Consultation Services in Oakland. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
And last but not least, Richard M. Lee, professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, gosh, where to begin? Why don't we start with how do you hold on to the functioning adult you know yourself to be when everybody else is treating you like you just stepped out of a time machine wearing braces? Richard, do you want to give us a start on that one?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'd like to start by asking the question, is it really a regression when you're spending time with your families during the holidays, or can we think of it more as an opportunity? And I guess the questions that I would ask first as we move into the holidays here would be, what are the past parts of you that you're okay with, and what parts are you not okay with reengaging when you visit with your family? And then once you sort of figure out what parts you are okay with, how can you sort of set your goals toward maintaining that aspect of who you were and who you still are and want to be versus sort of regressing to the things that you're no longer, but that others may want to try to pull out of you.
Aretha, I guess what we're talking about here are those dynamics where we see the parts of ourselves we don't like to see come back.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when you are with your family, you fall into the role that you learned as a child. And it's really easy to fall back into those roles when there are situations where it's kind of hard to remember that you are this successful adult in the world with loving relationships and your sister's across from you and she's saying certain things. And you instantly fall back into that 13-year-old. What I do with a lot of clients is I support them in really looking at self-care. Like, who are you? Who do you want to be? How do you not react? And just doing some really mindful things in the moment to help center yourself so that you can remember, yeah, I was that 13-year-old bratty person, but I am this really successful school teacher now. I don't have to respond to whatever my sister is struggling with.
Kelsey, anything you want to add there?
I think, too, as Richard had said about what I heard in him saying was that you're sometimes, too, making a choice about what part of you are you just going to kind of keep on as a role and what part of you do you really want to shed? Because no one wants a school teacher around when you're in the kitchen, right, trying to tell you what to do. So it is a bit of an adjustment when you're with your family. And I think it's all about how do you sort of accommodate to the dynamic that's there, and how do you individuate to who you are and what you want to present both to your family and for your own sense of, you know, efficacy.
With Thanksgiving being not so far away in the past, I imagine there are a lot of listeners right now who are immediately recalling a moment of holiday regression. But Kelsey, can you share an example either from your own life or something you've come across professionally that would be an example of holiday regression?
Oh, sure. I'll share my own life. So I grew up with a mom, just my mom. So it was just the two of us. So the holidays were a time when I really pitched in a lot. And she wasn't always very high functioning. So if it was going to be festive, I was going to take charge. And I've noticed in the holiday season now with my small family, my husband and my daughter, and then my in-laws, and that I wind up taking responsibility for most of the festivities. And it's not something I typically do. I'm not usually in charge of the kitchen, but during the holidays, it's when I take over. And it's only with this theme of regression that I understood that's what I'm doing. And it's not completely dysfunctional. In some ways, it kind of prepared me.
Somebody's got to
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
And I try to take joy in it, that I can actually do this. And maybe there would be a risk of loss of control if I didn't. So on the one hand, it could be considered a burden. But on the other hand, it's an opportunity. So that's what I do.
Richard, anything you want to share?
Yeah, I'm actually getting ready to leave for a family reunion for Christmas. And I have the youngest of three brothers. And we definitely feel that pull to play your role as the youngest son or the younger brother. And I think what I always have to remind myself is sort of what's the main reason or goal? Why am I going back? You know, what's the purpose of getting all together? And for me, it's really remembering that it's to affirm our relationships that we have with our family members, and how we're sort of building new traditions, because, you know, my mom's passed away, my father's still with us. But he's kind of taken more of a back seat. And now it's time for my brothers and I to really sort of create new traditions for our children. And so that's kind of what I'm always trying to remind myself as we move into the holidays.
What a beautiful thought. Create new traditions. I'd like to do that. Aretha, any stories you want to share?
Yeah, recently I was at a celebration and was having a conversation with a friend, and I want us to keep in mind that holiday regression isn't just about regression when you're with your family of origin, but it could be with your work family, it could be with your social circle. And so this friend and I were having this conversation, and one of my roles, childhood roles, as a child, I was really quiet. When there was stressful things happening, I would become really quiet and almost disappear. And so in this conversation with her, she wasn't hearing what I had to say. And although I said, okay, Aretha, you're an adult. There's some skills that you've learned. How do you say what you need and be very clear? And I was making very pointed I statements. I feel, I think, I don't think you're hearing me. And she couldn't hear what I had to say. And it was like an out-of-body experience. I saw myself shrink down, sit back, and become very quiet. And in this moment, I was like, oh, my gosh, Aretha, what are you doing? You need to speak up, and you need to demand that she hears you. And then I was like, no, Aretha, you have a choice here. You can make a point of her not hearing you, but would it go anywhere? And people think that when you do this, that it can take hours to actually have this thought, this conversation with yourself. And it was really just a matter of seconds. And I said, no, I'm not going to push the point because she won't hear me. This will lead to an argument. So what am I going to do in this moment to take care of myself? That it was okay for me to sit back and be quiet and allow her to say what she needed to say, because it wasn't disrespectful. It wasn't threatening. Was it uncomfortable? Yes, but it was a level of discomfort that I could live with. And then I came back And then I said, you know what? Tell me about this football game that you're going to next week. Who's playing? So then I changed the conversation, and she followed right along.
You raise a really interesting point, which is that when you're talking about family dynamics, you're not in control of the entire room. You've just got yourself, and maybe you've worked through some issues that make it possible for you to step out of your role, but other people are trying to pull you back in to the dynamic because they haven't worked it through. It's sort of like the family is snapping back like a rubber band.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And that's, you know, family is our original source of how we develop relationships and how we identify. And that's why it's so easy to fall back into those roles, because that was your first experience of relationship and what does it mean to communicate, and can you communicate effectively, and can you say how you feel, or do we keep things on the surface? And so when you are in these original roles, you repeat the behavior over and over and over again, and then it becomes internalized. This is how you operate.
Kelsey, I'm wondering if you can talk to something else, which is, you know, the pressure that so many of us put on holidays. We have this idealized vision of how the holidays should be celebrated. We have an idealized vision of how our family should behave during the holidays. And so much of the frustration, I know I feel, around this time of year is the ways in which the ideal is not manifested.
Yeah. I think family, more than almost any other unit, is really bonded by emotion and expectations. The emotion is what causes us to care for each other and prioritize each other, and expectations, obligation, are what kind of compel us to prioritize this person over somebody else. But in that mix of expectation and emotion is the reality of disappointment, because people can never always fulfill your expectations. And I think that's what's different about having discordant belief systems, having different ideas about what things should look like, what they should be like. When do you open the presents? What do you serve at the holiday meal? How do you acknowledge somebody who you've lost? What are the new traditions that you're going to establish? What do you let go? When people don't see eye to eye, it's very loaded, potentially. And so I think one of the best ways that we can manage stress during the family times are to expect some disappointment, like you expressed, Aretha, that you noticed a disappointment that you couldn't totally be yourself in that conversation. And you accepted it and could then receive what was being given to you in terms of what you were hearing and engaging in further conversation. And so I think often we're in a dilemma between expressing ourselves and repressing ourselves. And either choice has its consequences. If you express and it's not going to be met by the other person, that's disappointing. If you repress, you can feel disappointed in yourself. So it's just expecting that layer of emotion when you're with family and figuring out for yourself what you're going to ride out and what you're going to address. And I would suggest, for the most part, being mindful that an expression is, you know, can be kind of toxic sometimes. So you want to just handle that with care, like chemotherapy. Just do it in small doses and just being strategic around that.
I want to open this conversation out to you, the listener. This is your moment to call in. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. And now that you've got your phone ready, 866-733-6786. You can also tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Check out KQED Forum's Facebook page. Email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Lurleen writes, a lot of parents expect their adult children to regress, and not only around the holidays. Sometimes it's a way for everyone to feel younger and dependent on someone, which can be comforting for a while. It becomes a problem when people somehow forget how old they really are and how mature they're supposed to be. Any thoughts on that, Richard?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to remember that our relationships with our families are always growing, and you know, we go through different developmental periods in our life. And so all the family members need to remember that about each other. So, you know, if you're a single 20-something-year-old, the role you play in your family is different than when you get married or than when you have children. And I think that's part of the challenge is that everyone in the family is having to always renegotiate their relationships with each other as we sort of move through these developmental milestones in our individual lives. And that's when I think a lot of conflict can happen because the mom may still look at you as this sort of inept single person who can't really figure out what's to do next in your life. But you've been actually making a lot of strides. And so then the question is really, how can you communicate to your parents or to your siblings that you're not that same person, right?
Along those lines, Noelle writes, I was very hopeful that as an adult I could overcome the bad parts of my past interactions with my cousin, but her recent visit was very stressful and there was no reconciliation. She was stuck in her perceptions of me from the past and could never see me how I really am. I was disappointed in myself that I could not transcend all this, but maybe she's toxic and there's nothing I could do anyway. Any thoughts, Aretha?
Oh my gosh, there's so many thoughts. You know, a lot of our family systems may not be as healthy. And so, you know, it's difficult to negotiate these conversations when you're with someone or some people who are stuck in their own traumas. And so what we're talking about then is, you know, it's that balance of how much do I push and understanding that for self-protection, you have to have a boundary there. But accepting that this person is not healthy enough that you can have that conversation. Does it let them off the hook? No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that you have to accept their behavior. But what it says for you, well, what can I do to hold my power? There are certain things that I might not engage with this person with. And I tell people, have an exit strategy when someone is visiting or you're going to go visit. You know, in this age of technology, you know, where your phone is synced to your watch, set an alarm for yourself and then set a 15-minute alarm after that. So Cousin Allison, okay, we're at Grandma's house. Cousin Allison has all of these issues. She sees me as A, B, and C. Okay, I'm going to be here for an hour. And then when that alarm buzzes on my watch, oh, you know, Grandma, it's time for me to go scan the room. It was great seeing everybody. And if I'm feeling a little anxious about leaving, I have another alarm set for another 10, 15 minutes. And that second alarm goes off, you know, scan the room again. Love everybody. See you next year. So it's really about what can you do to hold your power so that you're not trying to change someone who is so entrenched in their beliefs.
Let's go to the phones now and Sir Pa in Berkeley. Hi, Sir, are you there?
Okay, I'm here, yeah?
Yes, tell us your story. Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I wanted to call in because here I am cooking my traditional rutabaga casserole, and I'm from Finland. And as my late husband told me, I have totally put myself in a box because I created this magical Christmas Eve, which, you know, it's not really just the Finnish Christmas Eve, but it's what I imagine Christmas would look like. So now I'm in this box where I have to do it year after year after year. And, you know, I've been baking with five little ones in their elf hats. The real Santa Claus comes from Finland on Christmas Eve. We just sing with the kids. There's a traditional meal. There's everything. And I really like to get out of this box, but it's impossible. A year ago, my youngest has a new girlfriend, a Vietnamese-American girl, and the second meeting, she said, I just can't wait for the Christmas. I've heard all about it. So I can't get out of this. I don't know how to do it, you know?
Kelsey, is there some way that Sirpa can somehow invite others in the family to participate from the beginning, you know, be more of a leader than a recipient?
Well, I think she might be having a lot of people in the Bay Area knocking on her door.
Exactly. After that,
to join.
We're all coming over.
There's more work
Gotta
for
warn you.
You.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like it is. And I try to create a very magical kind of experience, too, in my home. And thinking about why you're doing it and if it's not fueling you anymore and being mindful of that, just adjusting. And I think it's perfectly okay to adjust what you do. As Richard said, you know, these things change. Families are dynamic, and how we celebrate can be dynamic. And if for you that means inviting other people to participate in a concrete way so the holiday stays the same but is done with more hands, that is potentially an option for you. Or you may just want to let things go. I know as a host, sometimes you don't want other people to work. That's part of your gift to people. But if you want to recreate that magic, I would then assign that task to some other people. But just giving yourself permission to let it go a little bit, because people are going to start to feel that weight and that resentment. And then you're not really giving as much as you maybe think you are. Is my sense.
Richard, can you envision a way in which it's possible to say, hey, I want to redefine the magic of the holidays as we've come to define it?
Yeah, I think Sirpa's already starting that process by mentally preparing herself for sort of what the next iteration is going to look like. And so there is this part where you need to just mentally prepare yourself in advance for these conversations that you're wanting to have with your family members. And then it can help really to actually rehearse these behaviors, talk it out loud, whether it's to yourself or to your partner, to just introduce this idea in conversation. We often imagine these conversations in our heads, but then we stumble with our words when we're actually face-to-face with someone. So rehearsing it, role-playing it can be helpful. And then the other is to really think about this in terms of the intergenerational transmission of culture and introducing it in that way to the family that, you know, I'm getting up in years. I'd love to pass these traditions down to you. Let's bring you into the kitchen so you can learn some of these meals or introduce new meals that you want the family to have in the future. And so now everyone feels invited into the kitchen to begin creating these new traditions.
I love that idea. We're talking about holidays, the family, and behavior, good, bad, and ugly, with Kelsey Crowe, empathy researcher and co-author of There Is No Good Card for This, Aretha Hampton, Oakland-based licensed clinical social worker, and Richard M. Lee, psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. What's your story? What's your question? Call us at 866-733-6786. Reach out to us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Email your questions to forum@kqed.org. But whatever you do, stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking about holiday regression, how to cope with it, frankly, with Kelsey Crowe, empathy researcher and co-author of There Is No Good Card for This, Aretha Hampton, Oakland-based licensed clinical social worker, and Richard M. Lee, professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. We want your comments, questions, stories, hopefully stories of triumph. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Richard, I want to ask about your research specifically surrounding role expectations in Asian American families. What have you found?
Yeah, you know, I think when we think about the holidays, we often think of sort of the white picket fence and the Christmas tree and so forth, really very white cultural traditions. But, you know, families are very diverse. We come from all different parts of the world. And for a lot of Asian American immigrant families in particular, their relationships with each other are strongly defined by the role you play, right? Your personal identities are often and needs are often secondary to, you know, the role you play as a mother or as the oldest son or the youngest daughter. And that can in itself create a lot of tension, especially as we're sort of surrounded by sort of this white American sort of ideal of what are the holidays. And so the kids growing up in the U.S. often have a different set of expectations of what they're wanting, but their parents, right, as immigrants, still have all these strong roles that they're expecting each person to play. And so that can lead to a lot of psychological distress and conflict within the family that can be difficult to navigate even as we move into adulthood ourselves.
It seems like you're in a situation, as you've described, where you might have one idea of how you want to be with your family, but your family has another idea, and they're going to stick to their guns.
Right, yeah. And so these parents oftentimes will have, as mentioned earlier, you know, certain expectations and obligations for what everyone should be doing in the family. And, you know, as the children or the grandchildren, they may be wanting to do very different things. And so it's easy then what we find in our research that a lot of times we'll often blame ourselves or our parents for these kinds of intergenerational cultural conflicts, but that only exacerbates the distress that we feel, not surprisingly. And similar to what was mentioned earlier, we can't really solve these problems when there are relational dynamics at play, right? We're just one party in a larger sort of system. And so what can often be the most beneficial, as Aretha and Kelsey have brought up already, is really sort of cognitively restructuring or reframing the situation so that it is more tolerable, and then to seek support. And we find that those are really the coping strategies that can help people rather than sort of trying to blame each other as being too traditional or too Americanized. Because those, you know, we can't change that situation, you know. We've been socialized that way our whole lives.
So explain how, you know, solutions-focused journalism here. How mm-hmm. do you go into a situation and change it? How do you argue when your mm-hmm. parent, for instance, might be consciously or unconsciously unable to accept that you want to go in a different direction?
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, you kind of have to prepare and be proactive. So rather than wait until the moment there's a conflict, rather when there's a moment in your relationship with your parent where things are going pretty well, to bring up this conversation around generational differences and cultural differences and how we were raised and how we're growing up. One of the things I often will say with families is, you know, parents grew up understanding who they were before they immigrated to this country. So their understanding of being Korean or Thai is very different than my understanding growing up in the United States. And getting parents to understand that we grew up in different contexts and different worlds often sort of opens the door for greater conversation and space rather than just being disappointed in each other.
Beautifully put. You know, in a somewhat related sense, Kelsey, I'm wondering if you can talk about your research involving political differences in families. I'm thinking of at least one friend who says since her brother went over to the dark side, I'll leave it to you listeners to figure out which one that is. But, you know, that it's almost like a death in the family. She feels like she's lost him.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, even harkening back to what Richard said around transcultural experiences within a family, this idea that life didn't go as planned. And so for a parent whose child is doing something different from what they planned, how do you address that? How do you acknowledge disappointment without infecting the rest of your time together? Because disappointment is such a noxious ingredient to family. And with political differences, this came up time and time again. It's funny, when I started my research, I was thinking that it would be very similar to my first book, you know, difficult conversations, that one about times of suffering, this one about political differences. The rationale for having those conversations in time of suffering seemed very obvious, right? But actually, in the course of interviewing people who voted for Trump and those who didn't, what I had underestimated, despite the benefits of civic discourse and getting to know each other and understand each other, was the weight of disappointment. That when somebody doesn't believe what you believe, especially around politics right now, where we are so affectively, emotionally ignited by these different beliefs and have so many constellational belief systems surrounding that, that it's hard to tolerate being around somebody else. So often the families where the most love and admiration was expressed for the person who voted as liberal, for the person who voted as Republican, in those families, what you tended to see was an avoidance of political discussions, which I didn't expect.
Just stay away from it.
Just stay away from it, because they knew, as Aretha, you said, it would be a dead end. And so let's focus on the other domains of family life, which are caring for each other when we're sick, when we're going through divorce, infertility, crisis, love, and try as best as you can to avoid it, which is not the solution I wanted to come to. And it's not to say that they can't be bridged in some degree, and there's certainly tactics and strategies for having these conversations that are available to us. But if you don't recognize that weight of disappointment that can come with it, and kind of, as Richard, you said, prepare yourself for that, it's impossible to just employ these tactics. So that would be my advice. And to really focus, as in all kinds of disappointment, what is the value in this relationship? What does this person offer you? Their humor, their steadfastness, their loyalty, their compassion, trying to focus on the other things, and then knowing you're just going to get really annoyed sometimes.
Just sort of accept the limits. I want to read these next two comments together because they're somewhat similar. Vanessa says, I'm the black sheep of my family. I'm the first to go to college, make a career, be successful, and most of my family acts as if I think I'm better than everyone because of it. I haven't attended any family functions for almost 10 years. Is it really such a bad thing to simply separate from people, whether or not they're family? John writes, after 3 years of therapy, I finally realized that I hated the holidays because I don't like returning to visit my family. It's like going back in time. I finally decided to start a new tradition with my partner and close friends. I enjoy this more, and yet my family does not understand and tries to make me feel guilty. Aretha, you know, it just... there's accepting the limits of relationship, as Kelsey's talked about, and then there's accepting that maybe you don't want to be related at all.
Yes. You are not in control of who you are related to, but you are in control of how you respond and how you engage with your family members. And it goes back to one of the things that Richard said, was having the conversation with people when it's not a conflict. When times are good, talking to your sister and saying, hey, you know, I noticed since I graduated from college, you behave towards me in a certain way. You know, what's up with that? I'm still Aretha. How do you see me now? And that takes a lot of vulnerability. But if we want to have the relationship, but we want it to be on healthy terms, finding that place of courage and coming up with a very short script and asking the question. And then if your sister discloses that she is envious because you've gone to college and you've had all of these wonderful opportunities, being empathetic and saying, wow, you know, can I support you? Can I share with you what I did? Because, you know, I had to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I have hundreds of thousands of student loans. And this is how I came to the decision of accepting that I'm going to have hundreds of thousands of student loans. And so then you created a bridge to repair the relationship. And then if your sister is, you know, just really entrenched in her beliefs about you, being able to say, you know what, I love you, but you know what, these are my boundaries. And then making the decision to say, you know what, if the relationship with my family is so hurtful. I don't deserve to be hurt, but I do yet, not but, yet I need to protect myself. Being comfortable laying down some boundaries and maybe even getting to a place where, you know, you're saying, you know what, family, I love you, but you guys don't treat me very well. But part of that is really looking at yourself as well. What are you contributing to the relationship? Since you graduated from college, do you show up and proceed or engage in a way that makes other people feel uncomfortable? So there has to be some self-reflection. What are you contributing? And if you walk away saying, you know what, I rarely talk about college. I rarely talk about, you know, how much I make for a living. I come around and I talk about football because my Dallas Cowboys are constantly losing. Then you're able to say, okay, This may not be about me. This may be about them, and going back to being able to set that boundary.
Richard, was it you who was talking earlier about the idea of, you know, planning ahead? And, you know, mm-hmm. so before you show up for Hanukkah, you maybe make a phone call to that one individual in the family who has a particular issue with your having gone to college or something like that. And maybe make a relationship repair before you walk into the living room and engage in the fight.
That's right. You know, we talk about the holiday regressions, but in most of these cases where people sort of revert back to these childhood roles, you probably would find that actually in most of the conversations that they're having with their family members on the phone or in person at other times of the year, it's probably not too different, right? So the way to change that then is in these sort of earlier moments, you know, before these big gatherings, if you can start to make little adjustments to the way you have a conversation with your sibling or to your parents, and then introduce new aspects of who you are to them in those moments, right? One of the things I was thinking about as I was listening to others speak was how when I've had my brothers come visit me here in Minneapolis, they have an opportunity to meet not just, you know, my wife's family and so on, but also my friends. And they see a different side of me and my relationships with my friends that they've never seen before, right? But that changes now their understanding of me, or at least I hope it does. I'll find out in a couple of days.
Right.
You know, and then it prepares them for understanding what are my new interests or my ways of sort of socializing and engaging with my children. They can't see that day to day. So having those sort of early preparatory sort of moments is really helpful.
We're talking about holiday regression. Do you revert to old roles when you go home for the holidays? Do you force others to do that? Give us a call at 866-733-6786 with your story. That's 866-733-6786. And let's head to the phones and Cheryl and in Berkeley.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, this is a really charged conversation for me. I grew up Catholic. And I grew up in Salem, Massachusetts. I'm 75, so I'm not a kid. So you can imagine my parents were, you know, part of the Second World War generation. And they had expectations for who I should marry. My family's French-Canadian on both sides. They thought, but I'm second generation. And I married outside my religion. I married somebody they hated. And so we never had a good holiday. That was always tension. And, you know, it was there before I married him. And then, of course, it got even worse. Anyway, he decided we should move to Berkeley, California, because friends of ours were there and the Summer of Love was coming. And so we packed up a 10-week-old and a 3-year-old, drove across country in a van. And I've been here ever since. But in that 50 years I've been here, I did a lot of work on myself, because no matter what your parents do to you, this is my opinion, and how they treat you, you still love them. I think kids love their parents. I did anyway, unconditionally, even no matter what problems we had. So I was in therapy, and I read a book called The Dance of Anger, and I called my mother, and we usually had a conversation where both of us ended up practically crying, and all the old stuff got brought up. I called her one Saturday and I said to her, Mom, I had had lymphoma and I had survived it. And I said, Mom, I don't know how much longer I have and I don't know how much longer you have. Why don't we just forgive each other, forget about the past and stay present together? A week later, I got a letter from her. She was in Mass and the priest handed out this paper on forgiveness and it hit her right in the heart, in her heart. And we called each other and she said, let's give it a try. And you know, when I went back for my next visit, I was rather anxious. And my mother and I were in a car. We were heading out to have lunch together. And it was a beautiful day. And we were talking about how lovely it was. And all of a sudden, my husband's name came up. And I said, Mom, that's the past. Stay with me right here in the present. And do you know that she never talked about the past ever again?
Mm. Oh, what a lovely story, Cheryl.
Mm. Yeah, it blew my mind. Because a lot of people I've told the story to say, I tried that with one of my parents, you know, whoever they were having the problem with. And they just wouldn't stop talking about the past. And I feel I really lucked out. So thank you.
It sounds like it. And it sounds like you did a lot of work, Cheryl, to get to that happy resolution. You know, Kelsey, I think Cheryl is bringing up something that is really strong for a lot of people. I call it relitigating. You want to go back in. Maybe the thing happened 20 years ago. Maybe it happened 2 months ago. But you're still trying to relitigate. And when you do that, in a situation where the whole family's in a room, bad things happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You mean when you try to relitigate with the whole family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to what this person has been doing or this thing that
I do think it's very important if you anticipate a conflict with somebody in particular in your family that if you want to address it, that you figure out how to get some time alone to do that. And some real easy, unthreatening ways to get that alone time is to say, will you come run some errands with me? Will you, and get the time in the car together or do the dishes or just come up with some kind of excuse to get some time together. And I think, too, naming potentially what you are feeling. I'm feeling like you're disappointed in me. And I can understand why that might be. Do you need to air it right now? Trying to address it between the two of you where possible. And also, I think there's always those sidebar conversations that family members have to help buffer each other or to try to play a certain role. Okay, if this comes up, then I want you to deflect and get everybody, out of the transition, out of the dining room or whatever, if your house is that big. So those are some of my strategies. And also, I just think, in terms of getting some of that alone time, people are walking into family holidays sometimes with some serious difficulty going on. They're going through a divorce. They're going through infertility, some job loss. They're feeling very vulnerable and very insecure. And to be asked about these issues in a public forum, depending on who's there, can feel a little threatening and defensive. So again, trying to find some alone time with people to just get real and check in and see how people are doing is very, very important.
Aretha, I'm wondering if you can pick up on something else Cheryl was referring to. You know, there are times when somebody goes ahead and does something like get married where the other members of the family don't have a vote. You don't need their approval to do it, and their approval is not necessarily desired now.
Yes.
But they're still trying to weigh in. You know, maybe 35 years after you married that person.
You know, it's when we have children, we have this idea of what we want them to be and the type of life we want them to have, and a lot of times it's because of our own things that we have experienced, not experienced, and we project our wants and desires onto our children as if they are an extension of ourselves. And so you have this child who has the audacity to run off with this person that you don't like because this isn't a person that you would have chosen for them. that is really hard as a parent, because how do you let go and allow your child to be independent? So that's a struggle. Then you as the child, you love this person, and they're a safe and secure person. They're a perfectly lovely person, and who wouldn't want this person, right? And so then how do you have that conversation with your parent and say, you know, I know you don't like John. John is a really good guy, and this is the life that I want for myself. And being able to make that statement just concretely. And then and what we always talk about is self-reflection, that you as the parent being able to step aside and recognize that this child, who's now an adult, is making really good decisions. And you wanted them to be an engineer, but they decided to be a school teacher, that this is their life. And to have that grief process, that no, they didn't do what you wanted them to do, but accepting that that was your plan, and maybe it's a dream deferred for yourself.
Mm. Dream deferred. Mm-hmm. I love that. Let's go to the phones now, and Mark in San Jose.
Hi. I have a little mechanism. It doesn't work for all difficult family situations, but if your family is, well, let's just say they can be judgmental and critical, and with a smile on their face, they could chop you down. Like I like to say, instead of tongues, they have Uzis. And it's sort of, but we're arguing. It's intellectualized and it's loving, but it's not, right? So one mechanism I find very helpful is don't engage in the argument. Not mean arguing, but sort of intellectualizing argument, or trying to defend your position or justify it, and just say, hey, you know, without anger and without, you know, fanfare, that hurts my feelings. And when you do that, in my experience, that just changes the entire script of the dynamic. And because everybody loves everybody, right? Nobody wants to hurt anybody's feelings, but nobody says it. Instead, we engage in the dialogue, and you just stop and you know what? When you say that, it hurts my feelings, and that ends it.
I love that. Thank you, Mark. Aaron asks, for people who are trans, the holidays can be a minefield, from relatives refusing to acknowledge the change to gifts targeted to one's former gender. What's your advice for these situations? Aretha, I know you've worked in this space for a while.
You know, when it comes to certain situations like this, I really encourage people to set a strong boundary, because this is your truth. This is your life. And when people can't see you for who you are, to be able to say to them explicitly, Aunt Clara, you don't see me for who I am. That does take a lot of vulnerability, but it's about being able to reclaim your power and walking your truth. And when you, and our caller who just said, responding, it hurts my feelings. When we set the boundary with people, it's like, you know, cutting to the chase. You're hurting me. You don't see me for who I am. This is my preferred gender. If you can't call me by my preferred gender, then my name is this, and this is how you need to refer to me. Being able to do that, but then having a community that you can call when your Aunt Clara is being incredibly difficult, or your mother or your father, whoever is being difficult, and having somebody that you can reach out to that will listen and be of support to you, because setting those boundaries with people who don't see you for who you are can be really painful.
And if there is an ally in the family, for that person to be a PR person to the rest of the family too, so that they can help you communicate what you need and what you want, so that you aren't saying the same thing to 15 people that might be coming over for dinner, potentially.
Yes.
Richard, is that something you'd suggest, you know, like instead of having a collective drama, trying to deal with it, maybe using an ally?
Yeah, totally. You know, I think the holidays should be a time where we're able to really affirm our identities. And if it's not a place where your identities can be affirmed, then, you know, you have to set those firm boundaries, as Aretha mentioned, find allies, or sometimes you have to just not attend or create your own, right, chosen family holiday. And that's what people are doing increasingly, right? Just as people have moved away from family time for Thanksgiving and moving toward this Friendsgiving idea, right? Those are places, new spaces where we can affirm our identities of who we are today. And it's not who we were in the past. And I think that's really important as we think about the holidays.
Well, super quickly, are there any books, or I'll say for each panelist, is there one book you want to recommend as we head out of this hour? Richard, you want to start?
Oh, God, books.
Just one.
Tough.
One title.
Pass.
Anybody else, or should I just say this has been a fabulous conversation? I wish we could keep going for another hour. I wish I could bring you guys with me to the next holiday gathering. We've been talking with Kelsey Crow, empathy researcher and co-author of There Is No Good Card for This, Aretha Hampton, licensed clinical social worker in Oakland, Richard M. Lee, professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. Continue the conversation online, because this is a good one. This is a great one to have. Thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.